A note to our listeners, this series contains disturbing topics and descriptions of violence throughout. Some of the subjects discussed include domestic abuse and sexual assault. Listener discretion is advised. Long before the People of the State of California versus Alfred Rollins was over, an active investigation to find Maria's killer, as far as anyone could tell, was interrupted. No other possible suspects were ever named in the homicide of Maria Rodriguez. Perhaps it seemed obvious to authorities that Alfred committed the crime, and once that was established, it may have seemed like a waste of time and resources to pursue other leads. Despite my repeated attempts to obtain any information from the Kern County Sheriff's Office, my public records requests were denied. I wasn't able to obtain a single document from the government agency that investigated Maria's murder, a case that is over 30 years old. Thankfully, the greater transparency of the courts made it possible for me to view at least some of the reports documenting their work. Perhaps they aren't overly excited to disclose information on or discuss a case that, in their minds, was solved but in which they weren't able to close the deal. They may look at it as a failure on their part. Reporter Olivia LaVoice.
If you ask the sheriff's department and if you ask the prosecutor's office, they would say, yeah, we solved it. It's just unfortunate how things ended up. Law enforcement, when they make an arrest, that's pretty much it for them most of the time. And there have been other cases, not many, definitely not many, but there have been other local murder cases where the suspect was either acquitted or charges had to be dropped for various reasons. And law enforcement and the prosecutors said, you know, the case is closed because that's our guy, right? We're not going to keep investigating.
And yet, there was at least one other individual that could have been a person of interest. And his possible role in Maria's death was questioned by several people at the time, and it still is to this day. I'm your host, Otavia McHenry, for Case File Presents, and this is In the Shadows, the story of Maria Rodriguez. Victor Perez was Miriam Rodriguez's partner for some time and lived with her and her children for many years. As I mentioned in an earlier episode, he was a violent and volatile man and intimidated Miriam and her children. It seems Maria witnessed his abuse and avoided being at home whenever possible. A fit man, about 5'9 and weighing approximately 160 pounds, he had fair skin with black hair and a long horseshoe mustache. They called him El Cubano, the Cuban, due to his Cuban origins. In one of only two photographs I saw of him, he has a stern, intimidating macho look as he flexes shirtless in jeans and cowboy boots. Victor lived under the same roof as Maria at the time Maria was murdered. When Detective Raymond informed Maria's grief-stricken mother of her daughter's violent death, Perez was at home and helped translate for Miriam, who barely spoke any English. Miriam's son, Junior, and his wife, Claudia, were at home too, but it was Victor that did most of the talking, and much of the information he related to the detective appears to be false. According to the supplement report, while translating for Miriam, Victor told Detective Raymond that Alfred and Maria had been having issues lately because Maria had been seeing another guy. Whether or not Maria had started seeing someone else, there was no evidence that Alfred was angry or jealous about it. In fact, if anything, it appears that it was Alfred who was two-timing Maria. According to the sheriff's report, Victor Perez also gave detectives an important piece of information that Maria's aunt Luz Brown had seen Alfred and Maria together on Friday evening, the day Maria was murdered, in a maroon car. If that were to be true, then it's likely that Alfred would have been the last one to see Maria alive. Additionally, the color of that car matched Alfred's father's, and the vehicle seen speeding away from the crime scene by the eyewitness, Dale Knox. So, of course, knowing that Alford had been driving his father's maroon car that day, and believing that he was an angry, jealous boyfriend, Detective Raymond might have walked away from that interview thinking he had solved the murder. Victor suggested both a motive and a piece of evidence pointing to Alford as the prime suspect. And within hours of that interview, Alford was behind bars. But when she was asked, Luz denied seeing Marie and Alford in a maroon car that night. And when I spoke to her, she said she doesn't remember seeing Maria that day. Whether it was intentional or not, Victor Perez's statements helped direct the investigation towards Maria's boyfriend from the start. The information he related didn't seem to add up, but still, the investigation never took a different course. It's as if authorities didn't want to take into consideration any information that might undermine their case against Alford. Victor Perez, according to the statements of several people I spoke to, as well as judging from court records, was an abusive and violent man. So it's even more surprising that detectives would trust an individual with a criminal record and a history of violence against women, such as him, to translate important information in the course of a murder investigation. On the contrary, he should have been considered a person of interest. I'm going to back up. After speaking with several of Maria's family members, I heard conflicting information about Victor Perez's role within the Rodriguez household. So I became curious as to exactly how he made his way into this family. This is when my interview with Miriam, her daughter Carmen Madera, and granddaughter Kathy Chavez became slightly uncomfortable for all that were present in the room, including myself.
That's something that my mom, I don't know, it's hard to say. I mean, my mom is the one who can answer that question.
How is it that this man started living at the house and entered our family? That's what she's asking. One day, some friends came by, and that's it.
He came with who?
With friends.
With friends.
Yeah.
In fact, what I would learn later on as I pieced things together was that Victor first set his eyes on Miriam's daughter, Marisol Stevenson. I want to pause here for a moment and warn you that much of the rest of this episode contains graphic details surrounding sexual assault and domestic abuse that are difficult to listen to. If you find those triggering, you may want to skip to the next episode. Marisol Stevenson.
I was about 13, 14 years old, maybe. I was seeing this Puerto Rican boy like a block from my mom's house. And I went to his stepdad's house to see if he was there, and he wasn't there. And
the stepdad said the boy wasn't home, but another man came to the door and, as Marisol recalls it, started flirting with her.
He was 18, 19, so I'm like, nah, I had no interest in him. Started walking back to my mom's house and through an alley. And before I know it, I heard someone say, hey, when I turned around, it was him. And he tried to force himself on me, and I fought him. He threw me against the fence and punched me. And I didn't tell my mom anything. And the next night, I went back to my boyfriend's house to look for him. And my mom was there with him. They were all playing dominoes and drinking. And I called my mom outside, and I told the mom, he just tried to force himself on me yesterday. What are you doing here with him? And she told me to shut up and go home. So I went home, went to sleep, and when I got up the next morning, he was in the room with my mom.
Right.
The same night I told my mom that he tried to force himself on me, she slept with him. And I woke up the next day, and he was there. And not long after that, he started forcing himself on me.
As I pieced things together to form a timeline, I arrived at the conclusion that this would have happened in the summer of 1981. Marisol would have been 13 and Victor 19 years old. Perez, who was about 15 years younger than Miriam, effectively moved into the Rodriguez house and stayed there for about a decade. To this day, Marisol doesn't know how Victor and her mother met, but it's plausible to think that it was Marisol he was interested in all along, and that seducing Miriam was just a strategy for him to have access to the child as well as free food and shelter. For Marisol, life became a nightmare from that point on.
He was my mom's boyfriend, but he was also the man that raped me for 9 years. And I told my mom what he was doing, but he's like, he came through here, went out through here. I don't know if she was scared of him or what. I cannot tell you what was going through her head. All I know is that I kept doing drugs and drugs and drugs because I had nobody to help me. I was never home. I was doing drugs because I knew if I was home, he was going to force himself on me. So I would go out with my friends and get high and drunk. I end up in juvenile hall so many times because I was always getting in trouble. I was like always in trouble. I would come out of juvenile hall and go right back.
Marisol said she started getting into a lot of trouble after Victor moved in. She often ran away from home for a few days at a time, and sometimes she would get into fights. At times, Miriam called the police on her and she was sent to juvenile hall for a few weeks or months. Marisol says this pattern continued for most of her teenage years. When she was 16 years old, Marisol became pregnant with her first child. When she found out, she was in a juvenile detention center. By that time, it had started to feel more like her home. To the rest of the family, at some point, Victor transitioned from being Miriam's partner to Marisol's boyfriend. As strange as that sounds, they were seen by others I spoke to as a couple.
Every day he would beat me and beat me. I was getting beatings every day. He would drag me, punch me, you name it, in front of my mom, my brothers. Everybody was scared of him.
Marisol's sister-in-law, Margaret Madera, witnessed some of these beatings.
When they would argue, where he would basically like strike her right in the face for like no reason, just out of nowhere. Well, nobody would get involved because they'd be together the very next day. Right. It's like it's something they were used to, I guess. I don't know. She would always get beaten and she'd stay. Like she would allow it. I mean, they would fight one day, he'd beat her. He'd leave, he'd come back, and the next day she would make breakfast for him, like a big fat breakfast, and I'll look at her with a busted lip, a black eye, and I was just like, how can you do that? But I don't know what her thoughts were. I don't know. And to me, that was a whole different way of life because I wasn't brought up like that.
You didn't grow up with, like, violence in your house?
Not like that.
As a note to our listeners, while comments of this kind are now regarded as a form of victim blaming, it is important to include them as they are part of the reality of some people's perception and the obstacles that victims of domestic abuse face. More about the subject later in the episode. The following is from Marisol.
And then I remember one day he beat me up really bad at my mom's house. I mean, I was outside and he grabbed me, threw me on the ground, kicked me. I got it cut all the way back here. Put dirt in my mouth and he forced himself on me and I got pregnant for him.
As she says her, she motions to Marisa, who is sitting in the room with us.
And my mom didn't know I was pregnant, so I got this little house, I moved away and I told my mom, please don't tell him where I am, please, because it's gonna kill me. And she told him. And he knocked on the door and he told me, if you don't open the door, I'm going to take this car and kill you. And I had a daughter already, my oldest daughter. And I opened the door because I was afraid he was going to kill us. And ever since that day, he just beat me. He would not leave me alone.
At 19, Marisol became pregnant with Victor's child. And Marisa Hina, the one who fought for this case to be reopened, was born in 1987. Around this time, Victor moved in with Marisol in the apartment she had rented. During our interview, Marisol refused to say Victor's name, referring to him only as her father, as she pointed to Marisa, who was sitting next to her in the living room of an Airbnb I rented in Nashville, Tennessee, where we met in person for the first time.
So, and when I would call the cops on him, he would come out and he would beat me even worse because I called the cops on him. So
he never spent a lot of time.
1, 2, 3 days, and I knew when he came out, I was going to get a worse beating than before. I mean, we barely have food to eat. We didn't have a car. We didn't have a phone. Every time he would beat me up, my sister would have to run across the street to the neighbors to call the cops. And the neighbors got so tired that they wouldn't even open the door anymore.
Victor Perez Valdez has been arrested and convicted for a variety of crimes. From what I can tell by studying court records, between 1989 and 2008 in Kern County alone, Perez was arrested 10 times. Five of these arrests were the result of domestic abuse offenses, and he was convicted on domestic abuse charges 5 times. In addition, there was a conviction on charges of battery. With regards to the beatings and 911 calls that happened during the time frame Marisol would have known Victor, she's fuzzy on the actual dates and hasn't kept any documentation. It's been a long time, and a long string of violence and trauma has contributed to lumping many of these events together or overlapping them in her memory. But I was able to piece together some of the stories she related to me with the help of court records. The earliest incident I was able to find a trace of dated from 1989. Between April 1989 and November 1990, just over a year and a half, Victor was arrested 3 times for domestic violence-related incidents. Additionally, another one seems to have been reported without an arrest being made. 2 of these charges were dismissed, and 2 resulted in a conviction. During this time frame, he also pled guilty to 1 count of battery. For transparency, I should pause here and explain the sources of this information. There is little trace left of Victor Perez's criminal history in Kern County. Most of the court files referenced so far were destroyed a long time ago, and all that remains of them are the dockets. If you're not familiar with that term, in the United States, a court docket is an official summary of proceedings in court. It's like a court schedule that gives you information on court appearances, hearings, etc. These dockets contain little, if any, information about what was said during those proceedings. They almost never mention who the victim of the alleged crime was, what happened other than the general penal code and section the offense falls under. They don't say where and when the incident happened. And while you can typically see what the sentence was, there is no way of knowing the actual time served behind bars. For most of these arrests and convictions, Victor Perez was booked in county jails, which are run by the Kern County Sheriff's Office. Following my request for Perez's jail records under the California Public Records Act, the Sheriff's Office has refused to disclose this information, saying in a letter that these records are, quote, exempt from disclosure. From what I can tell from the court dockets, though, the sentences for Victor Perez's repeated offenses seem to be very short. To make things even more difficult, the Shafter Police Department, where Marisol would have reported these incidents, has destroyed all the records in question. A Shafter Police Department employee told me during a phone call that there isn't even a trace in their database or in their files that those incident reports ever existed, since at the time, nobody documented the procedure by recording when and why the records were purged. In all likelihood, it's due to the fact that the cases are so old, in conjunction with them having been closed or adjudicated. As far as the reports filed with the Kern County Sheriff's Office, unsurprisingly, they are also, quote, exempt from disclosure, together with the jail records of Perez's arrests. Back to Marisol's story. Viewing things from an outside perspective, people considered Victor and Marisol to be a couple. They fought, he struck her, then they made up. They lived on their own for some time, and they had a child together. But Marisol doesn't see things that way. She points out that Victor sexually assaulted her when she was a minor. He was emotionally and physically abusive, which is confirmed by many others as well. He took advantage of Marisol, who came from a background of abuse and neglect, and a family where nobody stood up for her. No parent figure stepped in to interfere with his actions. The relationship they had cannot be considered a consensual relationship when it began with grooming and sexual assault of a child by her mother's partner. Although now, as a society, we're learning to shift the blame squarely onto the offender, oftentimes the blame is still cast upon mothers that fail to defend their children or remove access to their children from an abusive partner or family member. While it's difficult for most of us to relate to this, in some cases, people that haven't had a healthy dynamic in their childhood may continue to stay in an abusive relationship, and perhaps even look the other way when their own children are mistreated. Marisol has had to learn to come to terms with what happened, and while she's still sometimes angry with her mother, she's chosen to forgive her.
It was because she couldn't even help herself. You know, how can she help us when she was in worse trouble than us? She never felt love in her life. She never had it, so I don't think she knew how to give it. She was a provider, but as far as hugging and kissing, no. It was after my sister died that she started telling us, I love you. Yeah. She still remembers, she says, I regret not telling your sister I love her before she left that day, and I regret it to this day.
If you've never experienced family violence and coercive control, it may be hard to understand. That's why I asked social work professor and therapist Kathy Pruden for help. While Professor Pruden wasn't specifically addressing the events of this story, her general insight is helpful to understanding the dynamics between Victor and Miriam, as well as Victor and Marisol.
Again, I want to be careful because a lot of times there's a lot of victim blaming where somebody will say, you grew up seeing violence in your home, and so therefore you are seeking this out yourself. And that's really victim blaming to say that somebody is seeking out a partner who will abuse them, because nobody wants to be abused.
I asked her what would be a better way for people to express themselves.
To say is that maybe they didn't have healthy relationships modeled for them. So they didn't grow up learning what it means to be in a healthy relationship. And the other thing I think that's really important to remember is that abusers don't, when they start dating somebody, they don't start off with abusive behaviors. A lot of abusers are charming and can be very, very coercive and manipulative. Because for a lot of people, if you go out on a date with somebody and they are abusive, they're putting you down, et cetera, you might not have a second date with that person. The other dynamic that gets into why does somebody stay is an abuser is not always abusive. That they can have their charming elements. Maybe they're good providers for their family. There's a lot that the partner might say that they like about this person. I like my partner. Yeah, he hits me, whatever. But he's got all these great qualities. And I'm going to overlook the other stuff because I like the good qualities. And so that's what can cause somebody to get into the relationship and not see it coming. Because often the abusive stuff, it's a form of grooming. Not necessarily intentional, but this is what the plan is that you've got somebody who's in a dating relationship, and the abuser might not intend to be abusive. And I don't think any abusers will say, I'm going to be abusive. As a matter of fact, I was talking to a colleague who works with batterers who said that most batterers don't identify that their behavior was abusive. They usually do a lot of things or a lot of excuses such as, well, my partner made me do it. If she had only done this, this, and this, I wouldn't have needed to keep her in line. There's always an excuse or a rationalization. And so your abuser or will be abuser, would be abuser, might start off really wanting the relationship, thinking this is great. It might look very healthy and fine from the outset. And there's not necessarily any ulterior motive going on. But once the relationship gets then underway and is established, some of those old issues might come up for the abuser. Like maybe they feel jealous of their partner. And so they feel powerless on that. So let's just say you've gotten your abuser and their female partner has a job with a lot of responsibility. The abuser might get jealous of the attention, not necessarily romantic attention, but just attention that the female partner is getting. The other thing too with abuse is it usually starts off subtly. Isolation is one of the key coercive factors in domestic violence, where your abuser will start saying to the partner things such as, hey, if you really loved me, you'd want to spend all your time with me and not with your friends, or things like that, and starting to isolate that person. And so what happens then is then you don't get that reality testing. You're now sort of cocooned with the abuser, the will-be abuser, and you don't have that outside influence to say, hey, maybe this isn't healthy, this isn't going well. And so the point I'm trying to make is that this develops over time, and it usually develops slowly and subtly, and you don't always see it coming until the point where you're in a situation and, oh my gosh, now we've got abuse going on. At the same time, you might now have children together, you know, a family established, and that makes it even harder then to extricate yourself from the situation. So I think it's important to remember that you have a situation where the potential victim doesn't go into a relationship choosing to be victimized.
According to the statements of several people who knew him, Victor Perez was a heavy drug user. While he worked odd jobs as a mechanic, he used much of his earnings on his cocaine and heroin habits. Much like a parasite, he largely relied on his hosts, the women in his life, to provide food and shelter. When he'd been drinking or was high on substances, according to Marisol and her aunt Luz, he would become particularly vicious. Additionally, in my interviews for this podcast, several women have accused Perez of sexual misconduct. One of these was Margaret. She's Maria's sister-in-law, the wife of Maria's older brother, Eddie. Margaret and Eddie had been high school sweethearts, and when in 1990 Margaret became pregnant, she moved into the Rodriguez household with Eddie.
He was just so scary. I tried to avoid being around him as much as I could. He was so nasty. There was times that he would hold himself. We'd be watching a movie in the living room. He'd be holding himself, like grabbing himself. And I'd just get up and go to my room because to me that was disgusting.
Who, like, when did he do it? When you were there and who else?
Yeah, it would be me and the kids. It would be me and the girls. We'll be watching a movie and all of a sudden he'd come and just sit there and I'd be, oh my God, I'd just get up and go to my room. He knew when to do stuff and when not to do stuff.
When did he do stuff?
Whenever the guys weren't around. That's what I noticed.
Yeah.
When the guys weren't around is when he'd get brave or he'd start doing stuff or he'll go sit on the couch and hold himself.
Even in front of Miriam?
Yes. And she wouldn't say nothing.
Oftentimes, Margaret took off and went back to her parents' house for a little while because the situation at Eddie's house made her very uncomfortable. These events were also corroborated by another one of Maria's sisters-in-law, Claudia, married to Junior.
Like, I couldn't even watch TV in the living room, me or Margaret. We could be watching TV in the living room and he was masturbating right there. You could tell, like, grabbing his thing in front of us. He wouldn't even care. Like, he would have had no respect. He was a pervert.
In 1982, Miriam's eldest daughter, Carmen, had a child when she was only 14 years old. That's Kathy Chavez, whom you've already heard from on this podcast. Carmen, who had been kicked out of the house, was homeless and unable to care for her baby. So Miriam raised Kathy until she was 8. Kathy used to share a bed with Maria until her murder, and she remembers that her teenage aunt used to be very protective of her. Maria used to take Kathy into the bathroom with her anytime she showered. She'd have Kathy sit on the toilet and wait for her to be done showering, something Kathy still wonders about. It was as if Maria didn't want to leave her young niece unattended. If that were Maria's true motivation, then perhaps she had good reason to worry.
And then after Maria died, he started molesting me.
According to a felony report filed in early 2022 with the Shafter Police Department, Kathy Chavez said that she was sexually assaulted by Victor when she was just a child. Due to the sensitive nature of the information contained in that document, much of what's in the report was blacked out. It contains some details that Kathy understandably does not wish to share with anybody. This is what she chose to share on the podcast.
And then one night she didn't return and I started sleeping with my grandma. And one morning I woke up because, you know, this guy was touching me down there and he was a perv. He would do things openly in front of everybody in the living room. And I guess everybody was scared to point it out and tell him, hey, stop doing that. You know, they were afraid of this man. So it took me years, to tell my mom and everybody. I think I was like 28 years old when I shared it with everybody. I didn't want to keep that in me anymore. And I just, shared the things that, he used to do to me. And
many family members, including Maria's brothers, have only heard these stories in recent years. I spoke about it with Eddie and Junior, who seemed at times defensive, at times apologetic or regretful about not being able to intervene. While they mostly deny knowing about it at the time, and deny feeling intimidated by Victor, it appears that they were present during at least some of Victor's abusive actions. At the time, they were either too young, too afraid of Victor, or unaware of what was going on. At times, they watched helplessly as Victor took control of the entire household. Here's Junior.
Junior, were you guys scared of Victor?
Scared of who?
Of Victor. Were you guys scared
of Victor? I've never been scared of nobody.
Okay.
I'm a man. I don't be scared of nobody.
Okay.
So I don't know what to tell you, but in front of me, he was never disrespectful to me or nobody. But when I was turning my back, he probably was. And I want to get him by his neck and break his neck off, man. Seriously. I just found out a bunch of stuff right now that I didn't even know about.
Less than a year before Maria was killed, Marisol's life took a completely different turn. It started like this. She remembers receiving one last particularly violent beating that day. Judging from court records, it looks like it happened during the fall of 1990. She said she gave Victor money to go out and buy Marisa, who was a toddler at the time, some milk, and that Victor returned home in a state of violent rage.
I was taking a shower and I felt someone pull me by my hair and he just beat me. He beat me black and blue. I was like bloody. I mean, I couldn't see. And my mom tried to open the door with my oldest brother and they couldn't, and I hit him with the bottle of perfume, and I don't know how I had the strength because I was butt naked, bloody on the floor, and I opened the door and I ran out to the street butt naked, bloody. And my sister Maria called the cops because we didn't have a phone, so she went across the street and called the cops. And he chased me down the street with the gun, with the .22 that was my gun that he had taken from me because I bought it for self-defense, but he took it. And I come running in the house. My sister Maria gives me a nightgown because I'm running naked, bloody down the street. And the cops were coming, and I pulled my oldest daughter and I ran to the room. And me and Maria always had a knife that we would lock the door with the knife. And he's turned off all the lights. And he told me, if you don't open the door, I'm going to kill you. And that's when I got on my knees on the bed and I told God, please send me an angel because he's going to kill me. And I saw a light and it was my husband.
This is Margaret recalling the events of that day.
The very last time he beat her, we actually set it up, me and Maria. We set it up where we were to call the cops. If he were to hit her or beat her, we'd call the cops on him.
When police officers responded to a call at night, Victor was known to switch off all the lights in the house to make his arrest more difficult. Then he'd sneak out the back of the property. So that time, Maria and Margaret devised a plan.
Because every time he'd beat her, he'd run. He'd run away so the cops wouldn't catch him, whatnot, because the cop was always called. And he'd run and he'd flee away and then he'd sneak in at night. And then one time we were like, me and Maria got together and we go, okay, you know what? If he ever does that again, we're going to switch on the light, the outside light, and Maria, you run across the street and you call the cops. And I'll let you know when he's here and I'll switch on the light when he's here.
One of the police officers that responded that night was Jeff Stevenson with the Shafter Police Department. He responded to a call about the alleged assault of a female.
I knew who it was as soon as they said it's Victor Perez, and the dispatch said she wasn't sure if there was a warrant. I verified there was a warrant because of the call I had the couple weeks prior. We knew he was a flight risk, so myself and Lee Blankiff, who was my partner at the time, responded.
When they arrived at the house, it was pitch black. Victor ran out the back door, only to find Officer Stevenson was already there. So he went back into the house and this time ran out the front door, where two other officers were waiting for him. He managed to escape, but after a complicated pursuit through the neighborhood, Victor Perez was handcuffed and arrested.
That's his usual MO. Beat up anybody he can and then take off and run and hide and then wait for the warrants to come out.
Marisol and Jeff already knew each other, but at some point after this incident is when they grew close.
I'd see her walking because she didn't have a car. I'd see her walking. I'd stop and talk to her, try and help her get protection, try and help her, you know, at least get a protective order.
The last time he beat me, that's when I met my husband. He was the only one who ever stood up for me. And I've been with him ever since. And not only that, he adopted her. He adopted my oldest daughter, and we have a daughter together. So, I've been with my husband 30 years now, and if it wasn't for him, he was the only man that ever stood up for me.
Jeff Stevenson left Shafter PD shortly after and moved to Monterey, California, where he joined the military for a second time.
And he told me, you want to go with me? And I told him, hell yeah. I took off. When he told me, let's go, I left. I got my daughters and I left and never went back.
That was in May of 1991, and Marisol was expecting her third child, a daughter with Jeff. Perez tried to smooth-talk his way back with Marisol once he was released from prison, but he never managed to insert himself in Marisol's life in that capacity again.
I know he was a pain in the ass. I know when Marisol left with me and we finally did go back, he tried showing up and flashing a bunch of cash and trying to be a Mr. Big, but it didn't do anything because, I mean, talk. Even you said he's used to hitting women. He's not used to getting hit back.
It's unclear how much time Victor served behind bars following this particular arrest. But believe it or not, after serving time, Victor returned to Miriam's house, despite the fact that Marisol had met someone else. He lived in the garage. No longer having access to his regular punching bag, Perez started focusing his attention elsewhere. Several people recall him becoming more controlling of Maria.
I believe that after I left, he moved on to her and Kathy. That's what I believe, since I wasn't there anymore.
It appears that Maria told several friends and a teacher that she was scared of Victor, that she hated him, and that she had to defend herself from him. Maria's friend Lorena Lozoya recently revealed having a conversation with Maria where Maria said she hated someone that hurt her and wished they would die. Lorena sensed that Maria didn't want to discuss details and didn't prod her any further. Lorena has not responded to requests for an interview, and this information comes from Facebook messages she exchanged with Maria's niece. I asked Maria's sister-in-law, Claudia, why Maria feared Victor.
Why do you think she was scared of him?
Shit, I was scared of him too. There was a time that Junior wasn't here, and it was like around 12 or 1. And I was asleep and I just opened my eyes and he was right in front of my face. Honestly, I don't know where I got the strength to get that guy out of my room, but I started yelling, you know?
The following is from Maria's niece, Kathy.
I used to sleep in her bed. She would lock her door. She would make sure that door was locked. And she had a stick underneath the bed. And that, now that I'm older, I'm like, you know, she was afraid of somebody in that home.
Marisol recalls that she and Maria used to lock themselves in their bedroom by wedging a large butcher knife into the doorframe every night, and that Maria kept a baseball bat underneath the bed for protection.
I know she was scared of him because we were high in the room crying because he would try to knock the door down all the time to get in the room.
Several of Maria's family members remember instances in which Victor had denied Maria permission to leave the house with Offord, which made Maria very angry. Tensions were rising in that home. Maria's brother, Junior, remembers Victor saying that he wanted to slash Offord's tires. The following clip is from Margaret.
At a point, I was a witness where he got so mad because she came back with Offord from being out late. He wanted to slash his tires. And I'll look at him like, why? Like, why would you want to do this? Why was he mad about her going out with Offord? I don't know. To me, I have no idea why. But he would get so mad whenever she'd leave with him. And Maria would be in his face telling him stuff. Like, they would get into big arguments like that. And Maria just wanted him out of the house, but Miriam wanted him to stay there.
By far, one of the most startling pieces of information that I learned from Maria's family was that Victor and Maria got into a big argument a few days before her death. Margaret witnessed this fight firsthand.
I was sitting in the kitchen and they were arguing. But she was cooking, and he wanted her to cook something for him. And she was like, I'm not going to cook for you. You shouldn't even be here. And she told him, get the fuck out of here. My sister left you already. She left you for another man. What the fuck are you doing here? And he told her, shut the fuck up, hijo de puta. And it just was awful. It was awful.
What was awful? What happened?
The whole argument was awful. The way he looked at her, like if he could hit her, he would have. But
why couldn't he?
Because we were there. I feel like because I was there, I was seeing this whole thing go down. And he started just telling her, shut the fuck up, bitch, and da-da-da-da, hija de puta. And yeah, and Maria was yelling at him, what are you doing here? My sister left you a long time ago. What the fuck are you doing here? Get out of here. We don't need you here.
During this heated argument, Margaret said that Victor stood up in Maria's face. Meanwhile, Maria held on to the pot she was cooking with. It seemed like the confrontation was close to becoming physical. Maria's other sister-in-law, Claudia, was present as well and told me the same story. Normally a very sweet and private girl, Maria always had words for Victor Perez. She knew how dangerous a man he was. She knew he was capable of great violence. She'd seen it on her sister. And still, when she confronted him, her anger got the best of her.
I'm surprised that she was so outspoken with him.
With him, yes. With him, she would be clear. Because she wouldn't let herself be told anything with him. I was there when she would confront him. I was there twice. It's like the whole slashing the tires, the same thing. He walked out there and she told him, you slash his tires, or I'll call the cops right now. She was a very nice girl. She had a whole lot of respect. But when it came down to him, it was like, no, she wouldn't tolerate it.
Looking back at what we know now, it seems clear that Maria and her family were terrified of Victor. Only days before her murder, Maria got into a heated argument with him. Despite his criminal record, he translated key statements to deputies regarding a murder investigation. And you don't know the half of it yet. As you will soon find out, he may have even influenced statements others made to the people responsible for investigating Maria's murder. If you're experiencing domestic abuse and live in the United States, call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233 or SAFE for anonymous, confidential help 24/7 or visit their website at ncadv.org to be connected to resources near you. Next time on In the Shadows.
So I remember I went inside the car and the detectives, they did ask me, was Victor here? And then I had told him, yeah, he was, even though he wasn't. I was scared of him, you know?
I mean, 100%, people might feel ashamed for me. They might feel embarrassed for me. They might feel, you know, like you said, sad for me.
Well, it was a headstone that he wanted me to look at. And he goes, do you think this is pretty? And I was like, yeah, but that's something that his family, her family needs to choose. And he goes, I think it's pretty too. He chose it. He picked it up for her. He just wanted me to agree that it was nice.